small satellites are the lasting trend in the space business. They can save your life, and they are something that we benefit from every day when we use things like our cell phones or iPads. On this special one-hour program, producer Sherry Quinn explores the 26th annual Small Satellite Conference that took place this weekend at Utah State University. There were 1,100 attendees from all over the world, 23 countries, sharing knowledge, ideas, technology, and aerospace products. This coming up after the news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Imagine a spacecraft as light as your laptop and small enough to fit in your hands. Small satellites were in the spotlight at Utah State University this week. 1,100 scientists and engineers from across the world filled the USU campus for the 26th annual Small Satellite Conference. They shared aerospace innovations, some made new deals, and others sold their high-tech products.
Can I interest you in coming to a fancy 3D-printed rocket display?
Hey.
Yeah, we spared no expense.
I'm Alex Zajac.
And what do you do?
I'm an engineer for Planetary Systems Corp.
Can you explain what all of this is here?
So this is a new technology we have. It's called a canisterized satellite dispenser, a CSD, and it works for the various standards. So we have a 3U, a 6U, and a 12U, and the U corresponds to a single-size cube payload. And so the 3U is pretty standard for university sats, but we're trying to get people interested in 6U and 12U, a little larger. You can get more in the payload, more of what you're trying to, what your mission is on orbit.
Today on Access Utah, we take you there for a one-hour tour of the conference to explore emerging aerospace technology. This year, the theme is enhancing global awareness through small satellites. We hear about their crucial role in tracking natural disasters like hurricanes, tsunamis, and earthquakes. We learn about printed rocket engines, and we find out about the national importance of small satellites from a military space leader. Conference Chairman Pat Patterson, Director of the Space Dynamics Lab Military Space Division, joins us to present the meeting.
Traditionally, space was essentially owned by large, wealthy nations willing to spend a lot of money on space. As you now move into the small satellite world, meaning very small spacecraft, they're very low cost comparatively to larger spacecraft, it opens the door for smaller nations to enter space. And that's what we've seen here now. We have 25 countries represented at the Small Satellite Conference. When we had this conference the first year, 26 years ago, I think there may have been 2 countries represented. So many, many more countries are able to get students involved. They're able to get things launched in space. They're able to learn and come up through the ranks of the learning process and learn about all of the difficulties and things that you have to go through to get things into space and make them function properly and keep them functioning properly for a long period of time.
Small satellites continue to shrink. But according to Patterson, they have reached a plateau at 5 to 6 pounds.
And the reason is at some point it becomes so costly to manufacture things very, very miniaturized that the cost actually goes back up. So there's a knee in the curve now, and we have sort of, at least with today's technology, we have kind of hit the bottom of the curve. And if we want to make spacecraft that are capable of doing science missions, good science missions, and we want to make them smaller, they're actually going to be quite expensive. So they're going to be difficult to manufacture. Now, we'll see what happens 10 or 15 years from now. That may not be the case. This group of scientists and engineers that we have here at the Small Satellite Conference may very well 10 years from now continue to miniaturize those technologies and make it affordable to fly small spacecraft as big as a baseball or a ping pong ball. But today, those kind of spacecraft are really, really tough to build and complete because of the cost. Everything has to be done from scratch right now, whereas in the 5-pound, 10-pound, 100-pound size spacecraft, you can essentially, not quite, but you can essentially go buy all the components off the shelf from somebody, integrate them together, and you have a spacecraft.
Patterson has a real passion for the industry, and he is popular. Maneuvering through the crowd with him takes a long time, about 15 minutes to walk just a few feet. It seems like everyone wants to talk to him and pat him on the back.
America's most wanted.
It's obvious he excels at both of his jobs, the conference chairman and aerospace engineering. He says he originally studied spacecraft engineering because he wanted to become an astronaut.
Well, it turns out that I have bad eyes, and so when I applied for the astronaut program, they rejected me. But by that point in time, I had already caught the bug, and I was already a spacecraft systems engineer, and I had already started down this path of smaller spacecraft, and then I got involved with Frank Redd and Gil Moore and Rex McGill, the founders of this conference. And so as I sort of tagged along and hung around them and learned the ropes, that's how the small satellite conference kind of got handed off to me. It was really just because I was there and learning what they were doing. But in the business, even that I am at the Space Dynamics Lab, that's what we do. We don't build great big things. We build small sensors. We build small spacecraft. We're trying to do things in more affordable, more effective, cost effective, and shorten the time frame. Is kind of the approach that we've been using.
Over the past 25 years, the real focus of the meeting has been on developing new technologies.
How can we better provide a technology to do attitude control or to power systems for the spacecraft or communications? Now it seems that most of those components exist. They're built. You can go buy them and put together a spacecraft. And what we're hoping for this year with our theme, enhancing global awareness through small satellites, is that people will start to think of how now to use these small spacecraft in a more broader perspective. For example, how to perhaps track hurricanes or help people in need of support after earthquakes and tsunamis, or even broader things in space like understanding space weather or the sun-earth connection and how those things are tied together. So that although the spacecraft are very small, perhaps if put together in numbers of 10 or 20 or 30, they can begin to answer questions on a much more broader scale.
One of the growing applications of small spacecraft is emergency response. Brenda Jones gave the conference keynote address.
And I'm a disaster response coordinator for the U.S. Geological Survey in Sioux Falls, South Dakota at the Aerostatus Center.
Jones gets 40 to 50 calls a year for help from across the globe.
Could you describe what a typical day is like for you when you're, and are you monitoring a screen or what's it like?
Well, actually, I have a television in my office that's, on CNN or Fox News or something all the time, watching the news. But usually the requests, they come in through a phone call. And I am on call 24/7, so I have my cell phone with me all the time, and generally when I'm at a conference like this, I do get a call. It's just timing. We just recently started providing more support to the Forest Service this year, and so we've been very busy this summer with fires, and we usually have probably between 40 and 50 events a year that we support with imagery collections. It's all over the globe, and it's all different kinds of disasters.
Jones coordinates the acquisition and dissemination of remotely sensed imagery for disasters, a big job she takes seriously and passionately, but with a big dose of modesty.
So when something happens someplace, for instance, the fires in Utah, we were contacted by the Forest Service, and they requested that we acquire some satellite imagery to help them determine the extent of the fire and the perimeter and the severity of the fires. So we worked with our colleagues in the Air Force, and they purchased some spot imagery on our behalf for the Forest Service. And then we have a system at Eros where we disseminate the data to the response community.
That sounds pretty amazing. And so is it really fast? And how quickly are you able to get the data?
For fires, sometimes a little more rapidly because all of the satellite providers know where the fires are. So if they have spare time in the satellite, they'll task.
Agencies like the Air Force and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency point the satellites in the right direction to acquire the data.
And then we also use government satellites like Landsat, Aster, EO-1.
And so are these satellites there specifically for monitoring disasters, or are they there for other purposes and then they're also able to point right in these areas?
They're used mostly for other purposes, but they always step up when we request their assistance with disaster response. They like to support that community. It's very important for them.
Why does it take a day to a week?
It takes that long just because of the satellite orbits. They only cover locations every so often. Like with Landsat, they cover the same spot on the ground every 16 days. And the newer satellites cover them more frequently than that, but there still is scheduling time, and then it has to be in the right orbit.
14 agencies from across the world comprise what's called the International Charter for Space and Major Disasters, and they provide the remote sensing data free of charge.
So if it's a very large disaster like Hurricane Katrina or the Gulf oil spill, then we request their assistance, and then we get satellites, images from all over the world to use for our efforts. And in turn, we provide images from our satellites, the government and the commercial company satellites, for disasters in other parts of the world, too.
The most frequent occurring disaster is floods, says Jones.
And if you look at disaster databases, just I think they all point that same direction. There are floods all over the world all the time. So we support most of those. And then for flooding, they have radar satellites, which are able to detect the water through the clouds. If you have a regular optical satellite, it's like a camera, and you can't see through the clouds. So they don't do you a lot of good if it's a weather front that's causing the flooding. And so then we use the radar satellites. And our international partners have those satellites, and they have graciously provided us with their data many times.
But do you know how then they're able to see what it is that they're detecting from the flooding?
What they do is you can see the roughness. And so where there's water, it's smooth. So you're able to tell the difference in the patterns. It's not like you look at a picture from a regular camera, but it's just a roughness pattern that you can see. So the floodwaters are smooth, and it's very easy to detect where they're at. And it just sends pulses down. It sends pulses down, and then it measures how long it takes to get them back.
They've had to respond to big earthquakes in the past few years in Haiti, Chile.
In China, we've had big ones in the past few years. In the large flood events, in 2010, there was a huge flood in Pakistan that we supported. Last summer, the floods on the Mississippi and the Missouri were well supported by all of the groups I mentioned before. A lot of the imagery is used for damage assessment. They can see houses that have been destroyed or, you know, bridges that are no longer there, roads that are in trouble. If they get it soon enough, they can determine which areas, like of a city, have been most heavily damaged and get search and rescue crews there first. In Katrina, it helped them to figure out what kind of vehicles to take in for search and rescue, whether they needed boats or whether they could just use trucks or things like that. And another thing for earthquake, the scientists use the imagery to look at the faults, to see if they can determine the extent of the faults and if there have been new ruptures, if that really happened where they thought it would happen or if it happened in a different location. After earthquakes, they always look for landslides, and they can see that very easily in the data also.
In fact, they collected reams of data for the tsunami in Japan. And in one instance, a satellite zoomed into an area so close, it sparked a rescue effort that saved lives.
Japan actually has a membership in the International Charter also. It's JAXA, their space agency. And we were actually requested by JAXA to help them make maps because they received so much imagery that they couldn't handle it all. So we requested some help of some universities and different agencies in the U.S. And I can't remember the exact number, but I think we had like 6 or 8 different groups working on mapping, and they would make maps and we would send them to Japan for their use. Okay. And one of the maps we actually saw an SOS in a field. So we contacted the people in Japan that we work with, who contacted the civil protection authorities, who went out to see what was going on, if those people still needed assistance. Or you don't usually see that with satellite imagery. But wow. So that was a kind of a unique case.
Can you describe what the maps look like, or what maybe a typical one would look like? I guess it probably varies on the disaster.
Right. Generally what we try and do is take whatever kind of map the responders are used to working with, whether it's a street map or a topographic map or an image map. And then, like for a flood, they will draw the shape of the flood, a flood polygon, and put it on top of the map so that you can see through and see what has been affected. You can see if there are schools or police stations or roads or bridges that have been underwater, or houses, or whatever the case might be that you're looking for.
What have you experienced at this conference, and how are you able to take any of the information or technology that's being presented here and incorporate it into your job?
Yes, actually I've been getting all kinds of emails and calls and introductions from people who think they have ideas that may help. It's very interesting for me. I'm learning so much. It's unbelievable. It's amazing to me the ideas these guys have that could help us out. So, yeah, I'm very anxious to go back home and see if we can't make some progress with some of these.
When she gets back to work, it's not exactly what you might expect. There aren't walls covered with televisions and computer screens.
Yeah, I just have a plain old office.
Pretty amazing. You're watching the whole world, really.
Yes, from Sioux Falls. I know a lot of people say, "Where are you at?" And I say, "Sioux Falls." And they say, "What?"
That's really great. But so yes. What do you love the most about your job?
The people I work with. There are people all over the world who want to help others. And it's just unbelievable the lengths they go to be able to try and help people that are being affected by disasters. They're wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
And it's all thanks to satellites.
Yes, all thanks to satellites, yes. A lot of these people are actually like satellite engineers and stuff. And they have hearts of gold, so, and it's all over the world.
Very nice.
I'd like to thank the organizing committee here for inviting me to come, because it's been a real eye-opener for me. There are so many possibilities out there that I hadn't known about before. It's very, very interesting.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Small satellites are a trend in the space business that can save our life. And they're something that we all benefit from every day when we use our cell phones or computers. Perhaps one of their most important roles is in education. Back to Pat Patterson.
Assistance that small satellites have provided have really been as a training tool, number one, to our university students, because they can do hands-on work on these small spacecraft, and they're able to, in their cycle of maybe 2 or 3 years in school, they can start with design, they can actually do the build-up of the thing, the testing, all the way to the launch vehicle. So that's really a neat thing. These bigger spacecraft, it takes many, many years, and so a student can't get through that whole process cycle in the time that they're at a university. The other probably big piece that small satellites have really helped thus far has been in technology demonstration. So there are new technologies coming to the table every day, but it's very risky in space to fly them on a large, complex, expensive mission the very first time. So some of these small spacecraft will be used to fly the technologies to prove out that they actually function. Then once they've flown in space once or twice on a small spacecraft, which is much less cost, then they can integrate them into the larger spacecraft, knowing that they have already performed well in space. In the future, however, probably the most likely thing that you're going to see small spacecraft come together and really provide assistance for are multi-point measurements, meaning trying to, instead of making the measurement at one point in space, making it at 50 points in space or 100 points in space at the same time, so that you can really get a three-dimensional understanding of what is happening in space. One example that I understand, and this is just because this happens to be in my area, closer to my area of expertise, is the connection between the Earth and the Sun. So there are magnetic fields which flow from the Sun, and they tie into the magnetic fields of the Earth. And radiation being emitted from the Sun every day flows down these magnetic field lines towards the Earth, and they either are wrapped around and pushed away from the Earth, or they are guided in to the north and south poles, and they ultimately crash into our atmosphere and cause what we know as aurora, the aurora borealis or aurora australis, north or south. Well, in order to understand how those particles flow down those magnetic field lines, it's a very complex three-dimensional, you know, grid of wires, as you could think about around the Earth, and having one measurement of how many particles or what the field strength is at one point in space essentially does you no good. You need to have a whole bunch of small satellites located at many, many different points around the Earth, and then if you make the measurements all at the same time, then you can say, ah, here's what the picture looked like in three dimensions at this point in time. And then you go a couple seconds later and you keep trying to understand how this wave of energy propagates through our magnetic field lines which surround the Earth. From that, then, what modelers do, there are people who model these magnetic field lines, but they need that three-dimensional information to make their models better, so that they can then predict what's going to happen when the Sun has some sort of an event like a solar flare or coronal mass ejection. So it really ties back to the whole principle of understanding in three dimensions what is happening around the Earth.
Coming up in a minute, we hear from Paul Stewart.
Captain Paul Stewart, commanding officer of the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by USU's Anthropology Museum in Old Main. It's free Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturdays 10 to 4. Tomorrow's an exploration of archaeology in the Intermountain West. Information is at anthromuseum.usu.edu. And support for science questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the infamous labor padrone Leonidas Sclerus and why he was known as Tsar of the Greeks. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
At the beginning of the 20th century, labor agents brought immigrants to Utah to work in the mines and smelters, on the railroad, and in the fields. The immigrants were cheap labor for many companies, and the most famous or infamous labor agent was Leonidas Sclerus, also known as Tsar of the Greeks. Sclerus immigrated to the United States from Vresthina, Greece, around 1897 at the age of 17. After a brief stint selling flowers in New York City, Sclerus found work on a Midwestern railroad around 1900. By 1901, he was a section foreman, and by 1902, he was headed to Utah to become a labor agent. Sclerus championed Greeks in Utah. He, or one of his interpreters, often appeared in court on behalf of Greek laborers during criminal proceedings, which often resulted from anti-immigrant attitudes. In 1904, Sclerus publicly defended Greeks when a Greek man allegedly committed a crime against a woman in Murray, and local residents were calling to kick all Greeks out of the city. As a labor agent for the Murray Midvale smelter, Sclerus had financial reasons for keeping Greeks in that area. but Scleris's endorsement had its price. On top of being paid by various mining and railroad companies, Scleris charged laborers $10 to $25 to find them jobs. He also exacted a dollar per month from each of his laborers. Those who refused to pay this tax often did not find work. Some of this exploitation had serious consequences. A Greek laborer murdered one of Scleris' agents in 1908, and during the 1912 mining strikes, Greek laborers demanded and won the removal of Scleris from his lucrative position as a labor agent for the Utah Copper Company. And in 1915, Scleris was shot in front of his furniture store by a fellow Greek over money. He recovered. But by 1920, Leonidas Scleris left Utah and headed for Mexico, where he purportedly owned a mine. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were done by Nicholas Demas. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Paul Stewart is the commanding officer of the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. He will start his new role as the Space Dynamics Lab Director of Technology in October. He describes the innovations he sees at this conference.
DoD has built very large, exquisite space systems for many, many years. And the first ones were built at the Naval Research Lab back in the 60s. So we've got a very interesting approach these days. We've been harnessing work with Operationally Responsive Space and lots of other organizations to go down this path. It was actually a Navy four-star admiral many years ago who suggested some of these more rapid response capabilities. And in order to make those innovations come about, that rapid response needs to be through small innovative companies. And so we embrace the concept of bringing together not just American companies, but international bodies as well, and international organizations where we can work collaboratively together. So when you think DoD, most people think classified applications, but we're very interested in environmental sensors. We're interested in space and solar sensors. And a lot of those data streams are unclassified and used by both the science side and then also by the operational side to look at how they affect other systems. So back to your question, some of the most innovative ideas I think are coming out of some of what we call garage shops, some of the small innovative thinkers. And so I attend about 50% of the technical sessions, and there's some really interesting ideas out there and some concepts that we in DoD haven't really thought of. So we use this as a place to gather ideas and to join one another together.
And how many years have you been coming to this conference?
This will be my third year. I've been in the Navy about 29 years. I go to a lot of conferences, primarily in S&T, Science and Technology. This is one of the most enjoyable conferences because it brings together a very interesting mix of people that are very focused on small satellite technologies, applications, algorithms for control, and a lot of areas of what we call autonomy. And autonomy crosses lots of different spectrums for the U.S. Navy. It's underwater, it's above water, it's in the air. You know, if we operate multiple platforms in the air, and then it goes well out into space. So if we're going to put out multiple CubeSats or small satellites in one burst or disperse them in over an area, they all need to be able to communicate one with another. So that's one of the most exciting things I think that I enjoy coming out here for.
One of the emerging innovations Stewart is excited about is a 3D printed rocket engine invented by USU alum Walter Holmans. True to his character, Holmans took a risk and turned an idea into reality. He convinced a few of his colleagues to take a chance on building it. They tested the printed rocket. Yes, I said printed, like the prints you get from a copy machine. At the Logan Airport earlier this week.
All right, Matt Duschke and I have been working together for several years on rocket propulsion. What we have here is our 6U canisterized satellite dispenser that we're developing for the Department of Defense. What we have here is a printed payload reaction mass that we'll be using in the qualification testing of this. Because we've been working so closely with experimental propulsion labs, we decided to add on a printed rocket engine designed and tested by Matt Dushku. We want to show people that it is not impossible to make a relatively safe, high-performance rocket engine for the use of CubeSats and things like that.
3, 2, 1.
I caught up with Holmans right after the test.
Everything we did worked, not a lot of drama, just perfect.
And so what did that prove?
What it proved is you can now safely propel CubeSats. We've demonstrated that beyond a shadow of a doubt that these things will be safe, and we can use them now to propel satellites that are an order of magnitude smaller than the satellites we were building just 5 years ago. So this is a brave new world in satellite technology.
Holmans came up with the idea and then gave it to engineer Matt Dushku, who figured out how to make it.
Well, thanks for coming out.
Yeah, congratulations. How did you feel about it?
Oh, I'm very, very happy. It was everything we thought it would be, which is what you want. So
what's next after this?
So we need to do some more qualifying of the performance. We want to look at exact performance numbers over the burn duration, quantify that so we have that data. So when a customer says, hey, we'd like to order one of your rocket motors, what can it do? And we say, okay, well, here's the data. And then they can take that performance data, plan their mission for the satellite, and then, you know, everyone kind of, you know, understands, you know, what the performance is. So tonight demonstrated that capability of an integrated motor with a satellite frame. It had a cold gas reaction control subsystem that rotated the satellite as if it was in space and you needed to rotate the satellite. Then the cold gas would do that for us. And then the main motor gets you going places. It either helps you do orbital changes and maybe even possibly get you kicked off to the moon. It has, you know, enough power to do that. So all those functionalities we just demonstrated tonight in an integrated system, and that allows the space community that builds these small satellites to say, hey, we got this other option over here. I saw it work. And because I saw it work, let's go talk to these guys and see if it would fit our program and what we're trying to accomplish. And that's what we really were here to do.
Now you can print an engine in a couple of days. You can print hundreds of them in a couple of weeks. So you can mass produce self-propelled spacecraft. 20-pound spacecrafts can now be mass produced. You can launch whole swarms of them. And I predict... I guess I'm going to be wrong about this, but I predict in about 5 years we're going to be taking engines like this to the moon because they're that good. I mean...
Wow.
Yeah.
How much will one of these cost?
That engine costs a couple hundred dollars, and compare that to a couple hundred thousand dollars for the equivalent. There's people building hydrazine versions and ion engine versions, and they can be a lot higher performance. But they can't possibly compete with the speed with which they can build them and the quantity they can test to prove that they got a very reliable flight article, and they can't compete with the cost. Very destabilizing technology for the people that are used to building stuff the ways that have dominated the industry for the past 70 years. It's not going to displace large engines, but what it is going to do is basically enable really small spacecraft to do the kind of sophisticated missions that satellites the size of an SUV could do.
What are the sizes, ranges that they will be able to propel?
My expectation is that they won't be able to make these things much larger than propelling a microwave oven size spacecraft. But you know, that's okay because at present rates, these kind of spacecrafts will greatly outnumber all the really big ones. We'll have innovation rates from generation to generation that will mimic those of cell phones. So instead of waiting 20 years for a new generation, we might wait 20 months. And so what guys like Matt Dushku will be able to do is very rapidly make much, much safer engines, because they'll be able to build so many and test so many that they'll have so much data that it will not be arguable that they're unsafe or not high performance or too expensive or the wrong size and so on.
So this will shave hundreds of thousands of dollars off the cost, right? You said so.
Millions, easily millions, if not hundreds of millions. But we won't save money. What we'll do is we'll take the money we would have spent on a single engine and instead apply it to perhaps hundreds of engines. And with a swarm of spacecraft around a target like a moon around Jupiter, we'll be able to deploy, instead of one satellite that we took a decade to build, we'll be able to launch a very large rocket and deploy hundreds of spacecraft. So imagine launching 100 of these spacecraft towards a target like Jupiter. You could allocate several spacecraft per moon, and you can have real-time planetary studies of whole planetary systems. You can do that for Jupiter. You can do that for any of the planets. You can study things that require very large apertures. So now, instead of having a spacecraft with a very large antenna or a very large mirror, you can, in principle, put together hundreds, if not thousands, of these spacecraft and do things like synthetic aperture studies of the universe, of other planets, of radio emissions. You can use them for all kinds of studies of the universe. It's something I think a lot of the planetary scientists have been looking for. It's not going to make it all that much more cheap, but I think that it's going to enable throwing 100 satellites and 100 sensors at a target. So there will be nothing that we won't know about these planets, and it is reasonable that some of these planets we could image real time. And so we can see every event going on around. We could have these spacecraft in polar orbits around Jupiter and equatorial orbits. We can do the same for all of the moons. And if the planetary scientists can miniaturize their sensors and overcome the really big, tough problem, which is getting the data back, because these small spacecraft, no matter how much power you throw into their transmitters, can't mimic the capacity for the larger spacecraft to transmit with their much larger reflector dishes back towards Earth. Another really big fun thing is putting many of these in orbit around Earth and starting to look at Earth with orders of magnitude, thousands of times more sensors. So we can understand how the upper atmosphere, how the oceans, how our activity may or may not affect the long-term climate of the Earth.
I asked Captain Paul Stewart to comment on this innovation because it could have a serious impact on the industry.
I spent about 45 minutes talking with Walter the other night. He's a friend of the Naval Research Lab. We know him well. And it's very exciting. Those types of technologies, I think, will make some of the launch capabilities far more efficient. You know, that's one of the biggest issues for us at the Naval Research Lab, is if we want to put up one or two or three small satellites, we generally have to join rides with other organizations to put together. And so launch expenses are very high. So any type of innovative approaches to get the launch costs down and to be able to give some of these scientists the opportunity for rides so that they don't have to wait years and years for a launch opportunity and an awful lot of money. So I see this as a very innovative technology that will advance that capability.
And what are some of the best accomplishments that the NRL has done in this industry in your opinion?
Well, I don't want to brag too much. There's a long, long history with the Naval Research Lab. You know, it was founded by Thomas Edison, turn of the century, and this is really where space began in the U.S., Naval Research Lab. A lot of folks don't realize that. It's the birthplace of NASA with the Vanguard 1 launch back in the late 50s. It's the birthplace of the National Reconnaissance Office with the creation of GRAB, which was the first signals intelligence satellite. And so there are a lot of firsts out of the NRL. It's where GPS came from. Roger Easton is the patent holder for many of the technologies that went into GPS that then the Air Force embraced. So GPS and advanced GPS also came out of the laboratory. And so tied into that is precise timing and the concept of putting atomic clocks in space and very accurate clocks in space. So there's been a lot of firsts. One of the areas where we are leading today and continue to lead is in space sciences. The studying of the Sun-Earth system and how the magnetosphere, ionosphere are affected by the Sun. That is a very large area that's going to affect all of our commercial satellites. It's going to affect DoD satellites, and we need to be very understanding of how to model that. Now, that comes back to the conversation of our ties with Utah State University. There are some wonderful performers out here who have been working in ionospheric modeling for many, many years, and we have the Navy has funded them out here because of their expertise. And so that's one of the connections between the Navy and Utah. Everybody always laughs and says, what's the Navy doing in Utah? Well, there's some great researchers out here with wonderful work. And so the question should come next is, why is the Navy so concerned about space? Well, we use more space assets than anybody else because we are a Navy. We are deployed. We are way out there. And so we need over-the-horizon communications. We need satellite comms. We need accurate navigation. And so we rely far more than terrestrial services like the Air Force and the Marines. So for us, we are one of the biggest users and will always be as long as we are out there in front and being expeditionary.
What are your thoughts on space, overcrowding in space? I mean, the satellites are getting smaller, but there are more of them and able to launch more of them.
Right. So, you know, under the topic of space situational awareness, we're always concerned. And we have some very, at the Naval Research Lab, we have some very unique capabilities that we've been trying to put forward to essentially mow the grass, if you will, get rid of any of the space debris that we don't want. Space is very large. It's not overcrowded, in my opinion. But we need to be aware of that, and we need to be able to track everything because we surely don't want any types of interference. So having a plan for monitoring, for tracking, and for keeping that all together so that we can safely navigate all of our spacecraft together, I think is a very wise approach.
What space system should we develop to improve ocean observation systems?
Absolutely. So environmental sensing is my background. I'm an oceanographer by training and meteorologist, so atmospherics and understanding the oceans. We jokingly called me the whale guy for the Secretary of the Navy. I was the oceanographer to the Secretary. So we were very interested in being able, the environmental side of understanding the oceans, being able to track currents, being able to track species. And so there's a very strong connection between the Navy and NOAA, who has the regulatory aspects of this. So we are always looking at sensors. We are very concerned these days, I think, with where we are going with environmental sensing and the fact that we are not spending enough money as a government to build the next generation of polar orbiting sensors for environmental, for everything from IR to visible. That it's concerning that we may not have the assets that we need in a few years because they're all getting much older. And NOAA is aware of this, and many of the agencies are aware of this. It just needs to be put into the budget and pushed forward. That's more on the policy side. On the sensor side, we are always developing very interesting work. So we're doing a lot of hyperspectral work these days, and we hope to be able to put some of those up on some other platforms.
And what are some of the best accomplishments that the NRL has done in this industry in your opinion?
Well, I don't want to brag too much. There's a long, long history with the Naval Research Lab. You know, it was founded by Thomas Edison, turn of the century, and this is really where space began in the U.S., Naval Research Lab. A lot of folks don't realize that. It's the birthplace of NASA with the Vanguard 1 launch. Back in the late 50s. It's the birthplace of the National Reconnaissance Office with the creation of GRAB, which was the first signals intelligence satellite. And so there are a lot of firsts out of the NRL. It's where GPS came from. Roger Easton is the patent holder for many of the technologies that went into GPS that then the Air Force embraced. So GPS and advanced GPS also came out of the laboratory. And so tied into that is precise timing and the concept of putting atomic clocks in space and very accurate clocks in space. So there's been a lot of firsts. One of the areas where we are leading today and continue to lead is in space sciences. The studying of the Sun-Earth system and how the magnetosphere, ionosphere are affected by the Sun. That is a very large area that's going to affect all of our commercial satellites. It's going to affect DoD satellites, and we need to be very understanding of how to model that. Now, that comes back to the conversation of our ties with Utah State University. There are some wonderful performers out here who have been working in ionospheric modeling for many, many years, and the Navy has funded them out here because of their expertise. And so that's one of the connections between the Navy and Utah. Everybody always laughs and says, what's the Navy doing in Utah? Well, there's some great researchers out here with wonderful work. And so the question should come next is, why is the Navy so concerned about space? Well, we use more space assets than anybody else because we are a Navy. We are deployed. We are way out there. And so we need over-the-horizon communications. We need satellite comms. We need accurate navigation. And so we rely far more than terrestrial services like the Air Force and the Marines. So for us, we are one of the biggest users and will always be as long as we are out there in front and being expeditionary.
Okay. Right. And then what space system should we develop to improve our ocean observation systems?
Absolutely. So environmental sensing is my background. I'm an oceanographer by training and meteorologist, so atmospherics and understanding the oceans. I used to be we jokingly called me the whale guy for the Secretary of the Navy. I was the oceanographer to the Secretary. So we were very interested in being able, the environmental side, of understanding the oceans, being able to track currents, being able to track species. And so there's a very strong connection between the Navy and NOAA, who has the regulatory aspects of this. So we are always looking at sensors. We are very concerned these days, I think, with where we are going with environmental sensing and the fact that we are not spending enough money as a government to build the next generation of polar orbiting sensors for environmental, for everything from IR to visible, that it's concerning that we may not have the assets that we need in a few years because we're all getting much older. And NOAA is aware of this, and many of the agencies are aware of this. It just needs to be put into the budget and pushed forward. That's more on the policy side. On the sensor side, we are always developing very interesting work. So we're doing a lot of hyperspectral work these days, and we hope to be able to put some of those up on some other platforms. We put up last year, 2 years ago, we put up HICO, which is the Hyperspectral Coastal Observer. It's flying on the International Space Station right now. And that's a wonderful one-off S&T system that's up there flying for a few years on the space station, and then will be brought down. So we're looking forward to the next generation of environmental sensors.
And what do other countries have in the industry that you wish we had here?
That's a good question. We have an organization called ONR Global that goes out and talks to lots of different conferences and countries to see what is out there. We call it, and all the other countries call it the same thing, technological surprise. And we always want to make sure that we are all competitive. And so there are lots of areas that we watch closely, and I'm sure that they are watching closely. We all want to make sure that we are somewhat balanced. But it's a matter from a S&T perspective. I think for me it's a matter of spending. When I look at how much we spend in our country in S&T or R&D and how those rank with other countries, it's a little bit concerning. And this gets to the topic of STEM and educating here in the schools. In America, we need, in my opinion, we need to educate more kids in science and technology. And some countries out there are taking that very seriously, and they're educating very, very highly. You can look at the level of our graduate students and look at the demographics of grad students in the U.S., so that's a bit concerning, and I think that that's a much larger national issue. But from as somebody who runs a national-level laboratory, I'm always concerned about my workforce, and I'm always looking at the next generation of scientists and engineers coming in. So that is probably my biggest concern when I look at other countries, is they are doing a very good job at science and engineering and educating their workforces.
Okay, great. And then if you had a magic wand, what would you change in the industry, or how would you change it to better serve the DoD?
One word, acquisition. The acquisition process and how we bring capabilities into the Department of Defense is not a speedy process because we have checks and balances. So there's a reason that it's slow. And from a science perspective, we always want to, we build great sensors, we build really neat tools, we want to get them out quickly. Well, we do at the NRL because what we do is we generally build one-off systems and we go fly them and we demonstrate them. And then they go into, if the industry likes them, if the DoD likes what we build, then they go into an acquisition process. And that is where I see the need to fast forward some things. If we build something that's great, or if Space Dynamics Lab builds something that's wonderful, we should have an avenue to fast pass, if you will. We should have an avenue to get things through quickly, to build two or three into industry. So that we can get those capabilities out and give them to our warfighters, to give them to the defense of the young men and women that are on the ground or at sea or putting themselves in harm's way. That is one of the areas where I see a little bit of frustration, is we build these great systems and then it takes years to get them out there.
With the budget cuts to NASA and companies like ATK, and what is your outlook on the industry in the next several years and the effects that the cutbacks will have?
Well, I'm a very positive thinker. I think that the leaders of the country will realize that these are probably not in our best interest as a country for national security reasons. I'm hoping, and I'm always hoping, that things will turn around. It is a little unnerving to many of us that are in the industry, but from the positive side, I think that you've seen a rapid growth of lots of small businesses that are seeing some of niche as a development. And that's good, but I think we also need a much larger policy to drive that. So the national level space policy and where we're going in aerospace, you know, I grew up during the moon race, and that's what inspired many of us to go into science and engineering. I sure hope that we get to see that again, and it may not be a moon race or a Mars race, but that type of spirit in America needs to come back. And it's through science and engineering, and the aerospace community, I think, is, you know, on the cusp and on the leading edge of that always and always will be. It's a very exciting enterprise, and it's a very exciting frontier. So I would like to see it, but I think you need the top guidance at the national security level, all the way up to the president's office, of guiding that and steering it a little bit differently than it currently is.
Okay. And so the privatization of deploying the space shuttle and companies like SpaceX, then what's your opinion of how things are going with them? And well, they've been successful, really. I think they've surprised the industry.
I think they surprised the industry. I think they surprised the government. As a guy in uniform, I salute them. I mean, hats off that the venture capitalists and the investors out there have the drive and they have the innovative ideas to push those forward. I'm thrilled. And if privatization is our future, that's great. But I think as a government, we still need to help support them in many, many ways because we have needs and, you know, as a enterprising country, I think we need to look at lots of other means of doing that. And I think you need national level policy to guide that. But I salute the privatization companies that have come through and have continued to push forward and their successes. That's wonderful. We use them at the NRL. We have several launches that are planned with some of these private companies, and we're thrilled.
Okay, excellent. That should do it.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
For Access Utah, this is Sherry Quinn. Thanks for listening.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan. KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.